That's probably enough. I think I'm probably Gil's longest time student, me and Allison, perhaps. I've been with him since he started teaching in 1990. Mm-hmm. And before that, for about 4 years, I did Zen practice. So I've been practicing, I think, since 1986. So it's always nice to be here. I was here yesterday morning for half day with Gil, and it was such a pleasure to experience the new floor. It's not only lovely, but it's so quiet. It's very nice. So, what I'd like to talk about tonight might be a little surprising, but that nothing bad ever happened to me. And lest you think that I've had some, you know, privileged, silky life, I want to say that I've had my share of challenges, for sure. But I have come to understand that none of it was bad. And to realize that, and this has been said by many people before me, but that it's not the events of life that cause us suffering, but our response to them, or the way we hold them. And we live in a culture that loves to judge. We judge everything, good, bad, right? And by and large, we're taught that that's what we should do, that's important to do. But judging leads to suffering. And it doesn't matter if we judge it good or if we judge it bad, it still leads to suffering. Because if we judge it good, then we want to hang on to it or we want more. So we're grasping. And that's what the Buddha taught was the road to suffering. If we judge it bad, then we want to push it away. Or we may blame ourselves or do a number of other things, and that leads to suffering also. So any way we judge the events of life other than just as they are is going to lead to suffering. One of my favorite stories, and I've always thought it was a Buddhist story, but recently I've read that it's a Sufi story, so it must be both. And perhaps you've heard it. Is the story of the farmer who had a son. And this farmer was given a very beautiful horse. And one of his neighbors said, "Oh, farmer, you are so lucky. You are so fortunate. What a beautiful horse. What a wonderful horse." The farmer kind of shrugged and said, "We'll see." So one day the farmer's son is out riding this beautiful horse, and he falls and breaks his leg. And the same neighbor says to him, "Oh, farmer, I'm so sorry. What a tragedy. What a terrible thing to happen. I'm so very sorry that this happened to your son." The farmer says, "We'll see." So then the country goes to war. And the officials come to take the son off to fulfill his obligation to war. But because he has a broken leg, he can't go. So the same neighbor again says, "Oh, farmer, how fortunate, how lucky for you that your son has a broken leg and can't go to war." You get the gist, right? That none of these things, in and of themselves, is good or bad. Events in life are not inherently good or bad. They just are. And so accepting life as it is, accepting life on its terms, can lead to equanimity. But so often we don't do that. So often we judge what happens and we end up suffering. So about 30 years ago, within a 5-month period, I lost both my brother and my father in plane crashes. And at the time, you know, I really was totally unprepared for death. Death was, I don't know, it was a concept, I guess, but it was not anything close to me. And of course, I interpreted both of these events as horrible, terrible. And there was much suffering, particularly with the death of my father, which I thought was horribly unfair. And I was angry. I blamed him for dying, and I was angry for years. I had to do a lot of work to let go of that. Now, I can't necessarily say that I'm grateful for those two deaths. That would be stretching it a bit. But I can look back and see that perhaps there were some gifts. There were also some losses, obviously. And there can be to this day sadness, but not the suffering that there used to be. I now understand that death is a part of life. And that some of us live a very long time, some of us don't live so long, and we don't know. Mostly we don't know. We know we're going to die, all of us will die one day, but we don't know when, and we don't know how. And I've come to understand that it's not a mistake. You know, I thought it was, of course. I thought it was a horrible mistake that my brother should die at 27. I thought it was a horrible mistake that my father should die when I was 30 and I had a two-year-old daughter. Three, I guess. I thought those were terrible mistakes. Now I see that they were not mistakes. It's the way it is. I didn't like it very much. I wonder what my life might have been like had those events not happened. But they happened. That's the way it is. And I don't struggle against it anymore. I accept that that's the way it is. Now, sometimes it can be considered weak or complacent to just accept things as they are. You may be thinking, you know, but why would you just accept that that's the way it is? Or particularly when there are injustices or horrendous suffering in the world, it can sound very foolish to accept. But I want to make a distinction between accepting and condoning. When I say accept things as they are, I'm not talking about condoning it or, like I say, thinking it's wonderful. I don't look back and think, oh, isn't it wonderful that my father died? No. That, to me, can be kind of Pollyannish, and that's not what I mean. But I do accept that that's the way it is. That's what happened, and that's the way it is. It's not a mistake, it's not wrong, it's not bad, it's not terrible, it's the way it is. And of course, I have grown through those experiences as I have through all the experiences of my life. When we accept things as we are saying yes to life. Ram Dass said, "The world is perfect, including our efforts to change." And when I read that, I knew immediately that was true. In Buddhist practice, we don't talk so much about perfect. We talk more about things as they are. But I think the idea is the same, that things are as they are. You can call that perfection, or you can just leave it at that. That's the way they are. Another teacher, Byron Katie, has written a book called Loving What Is. It's the same thing, saying yes to what is, accepting what is. I might substitute accepting for loving. Loving can have that sense of condoning or Pollyannish, thinking it's wonderful, which actually in many ways she means. She talks about things that way. But I would say more accepting life as it is, or accepting things as they are. Eckhart Tolle, who many people have read, his book is quite well known, The Power of Now, says to do otherwise is insanity. To resist what is insanity. Why? Because we're going to lose. What is, is. So if we are going to struggle against it, we're going to lose. And that's suffering. And that's what not accepting entails. Struggling, fighting, resisting. And that's where the suffering comes. So most of us have been very highly conditioned to judge, both in our families and in the society around us. It can be very difficult to break through that conditioning, to let go of it. I've done so in many, many ways, and yet there are still things that I struggle with. There are still things that intellectually I can say, yes, that's the way it is, but the gut still reacts as if, no, no, it shouldn't be that way. Animal cruelty, perhaps, is one thing. War, the kinds of horrendous suffering that occurs in our world. I can accept it intellectually when I actually see it or experience it. The heart or the gut really reacts. No, that shouldn't be. That shouldn't be. Yet I've learned that to accept that, to accept the suffering of other beings, animals or human or whatever, although it can be very painful for me and very difficult, the tendency is to turn away or to not want to know. When I do allow myself to know and to accept it, to feel it fully, that's when the compassion arises. And that's when I'm able to act, to do something. But from a compassionate, accepting, loving place. Not from a fighting, resisting, or angry, or pushing, controlling kind of place. And that can make a big, big difference. Before the war in Iraq, many of us felt very strongly that this was a bad idea for our country to invade Iraq. And we did lots of things. You know, we demonstrated, we protested, we wrote letters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we recognized and we said to each other, and I remember being in a circle here shortly after the war started, where several of us said, but we don't know. As awful as it seems, as opposed as we are, we don't know. Just like the farmer, we don't know. We don't know that the broken leg is a terrible thing. It might be painful, but we don't know that it's terrible. And it looks like we still don't know with the war in Iraq. Many of us still feel it was a bad idea, but we don't know. And rather than that paralyzing us, it can lead to us acting, but acting with equanimity and not being attached to results. Now that's a challenge, isn't it? For most of us, when we do something, we expect certain results, or we certainly want to see certain results, and to let go of that and say, I'm going to do it, it feels right. And I'm not attached to what the result is, can be a challenge. But in fact, that's the way it is. We can never know what the result is going to be. And the truth is, in our limited perspective, we don't have the larger perspective. So in our limited perspective, we don't know, if we're honest with ourselves, we don't know what the best result is. Really is. We know what we'd like. We know what we think looks best, but we don't, in fact, know what the best result is. Makes me think of control. And back to the plane crashes. You know, as long as we have planes, there will be crashes. That's a fact. We're not able to fly planes however many thousand times a day and not have crashes. But we do our best. You know, we do what we can for safety. We maintain the planes. We train our pilots, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is we can't control everything. And I think of this in my own life. I've spent a lot of years trying very hard to control things, to control my life. And then ended up feeling I'd done something wrong or I'd failed or something if things didn't turn out right or the way I thought they should turn out. And I have suffered a lot with that. The reality is, probably I didn't do anything wrong. Probably that's just the way things are. And I don't get to control everything. So that reminds me of another favorite story. This one I think is Buddhist. Of the little bird. You've probably heard Gil or someone tell this also. Let me see if I can do it correctly. Maybe Lewis or someone can help. There was a forest fire, and there was a little bird who wanted to help put out the forest fire. And he was a very, very small little bird. All he could do, or all he knew to do, was fly to the nearby pond or lake, get a beak full of water and come back and dump it on the forest fire. Obviously, you know, that was a pretty minimal effect on that forest fire. And I think it was another bird, an eagle or something. Anybody remember? Anyway, you'll get the idea. Came along and said, "Little bird, what are you doing? You know, you have no effect on this forest fire. You're just a tiny little bird, and this is a huge fire." And the little bird replied, "You know, it's what I can do. It's what I can do." And the other bird, I think it was so impressed with the dedication of this little bird. Now, this is where I forget exactly how it goes, but something like he flew off and somehow warned or told somebody about the fire, which brought helicopters and planes, and the fire was put out. That's not exact, but you get the idea. Or the little boy and the starfish. There are hundreds of starfish on this beach that have been beached and obviously are dying, because starfish can't live out of water. And this little boy picks up a starfish and tosses it back in the sea. And a man says to him, "What are you doing? There are hundreds of starfish. You can't possibly make a difference." And the little boy said, "I made a difference to this one." I love these stories, because they point to the importance of doing what's right in front of us, doing what needs to be done without attachment to the result. We can't know. We have to let go of that. But that doesn't stop us. We do what needs to be done. It can be a paradox, or it can seem like a paradox, but when we accept things as they are, especially when we accept each other as we are, we change. And when we change, that allows other people to change. So it's especially true in relationships, intimate relationships. Perhaps you've experienced that. That when you came to accept you know, a parent, a child, a lover, a friend, whomever, just as that person is, and truly accept it, not just saying that, but you truly did, you were changed by that. And undoubtedly, the other person changed also. And it's not something we can fake. It's not something we can, pretend. It has to be genuine. But when we genuinely accept, that does allow for the change. And that's true with things in your life also. Things that may seem impossible to change. One of my greatest hindrances has been self-doubt. And this is manifested in ways like being shy, like feelings of incompetence or insecurity, that kind of thing. And I've done, over the years, a lot of work on changing myself. And I have changed, and a lot of it has been good. It's been a struggle, but it's been very good. However, I'm at a place now of accepting that that's a part of who I am. Because although I've changed, there's still that part of me. There's still that insecurity, perhaps, unsureness, that pops up every once in a while. Now I look at it as, how can I use this? You know, I've spent 50 years or something trying to change it. Now, how can I use this? How can I serve life with this as well? I was going to say with this part of me, but with all of me. With this part of me as well. Accepting myself just as I am. I think I've heard that from Gil thousands of times, and of course it was many thousands of times before it finally sunk in. Oh yeah, that means this too. This part of me too. All of me. And the paradoxical or the amazing thing is, when I do that, it doesn't matter. You know, it becomes a non-issue. It's just not important. And because it becomes a non-issue, it doesn't bother me. It doesn't affect me. Another very poignant example in my life of accepting things as they are has been my grandson. I have a little grandson who's almost 4 years old now, and he has cerebral palsy. He's also developmentally delayed. He's almost four and functions, acts in many ways, not always, but many ways at about half that age. He's an absolute delight. He's the most lovable little boy I have ever known. Probably largely, of course, because he's my grandson, but also because he is just a delightful, happy little boy. And my daughter said several months ago, and I think it was very genuine, I wouldn't want him any other way. He's perfect, just the way he is. If he were any other way, he wouldn't be Alexander. And we love and appreciate Alexander just the way he is. A short while after my grandson's birth, I had a client who had a little girl whose right arm only comes right below the elbow. And my client is someone who is caught up in perfection. And she never, ever gave a thought to the fact that her child might have a problem, a so-called disability. She was devastated for months. She's done incredible piece of work, and she now feels the same way. She would not want Caitlin any other way. And she still has low moments, or she still has times of, you know, pain, or especially when somebody else says something or notices or whatever. And I have a neighbor who has a little girl who has autism. And with these three little children in my life, I have come to see so-called disabilities very differently. They are not disabilities. They're different, for sure. But they're not disabilities, and they're not wrong. There's not something wrong. Somebody said to me something about, you know, you look at Alexandra, you wouldn't know anything was wrong. And I said, there is nothing wrong. I wanted that label to be dropped. Alexander is who he is. And that means that he's developmentally delayed. And Caitlin has a right arm that only comes here. Caitlin doesn't know there's a problem. As far as she knows, that's the way life is. That's the way, you know, things are. She's three now, and I think she's probably beginning to notice that other people have two arms, but or two hands. But I now see these as just differences. And I see that each of these children has a great deal to contribute from just how they are, just who they are. I have a friend who has worked with autistic children doing music therapy. And she wrote a book specifically about three of these autistic children. And, well, children, they were young, but they became teenagers, I think, as she was working with them. And she used with them the, what's it called, computer-assisted writing, so that these kids learn to type out on the computer what they want to say. That's been very controversial. But in all three instances, these kids separately, individually, typed out at different times, you know, but in response to her, that they had come into this world with autism to teach us. Again, it was not a mistake. Was not something wrong, you know. They came to teach us something. Many years ago, I was teaching psych tech students, and we did a field placement at a school in San Jose called Zonta Children's Center. And there was a mother of an autistic boy that came and spoke to my class every semester. She had a little autistic boy named J. Mike. And every time she would get tearful talking about how J. Mike had taught her about love. That she didn't really understand love until she had this little autistic child. And she felt the same way. You know, she loved J. Mike just the way he was. She was not interested in changing him or seeing that there was something wrong. J. Mike was the way he was, and he had lessons to teach, and she could learn. So I don't know, I've probably forgotten something, but that's pretty much what I wanted to say. So we do have 15 minutes. I'd like to invite your discussion, your comments. I gave this talk in San Jose last night, and I found, to my surprise, that a lot of people were really touched by it, that it was an issue for them in their lives, or they could somehow relate to it. So I'd love to hear from you. What does it touch in you, or does it? Dick?
I wonder if you could expand a little on the fine line between accepting what is the way it is, and yet not condoning or accepting things that our ordinary wisdom says are really not great, and wanting to work maybe in a political way or something about improving if you like, or your own life, the situation for people in certain situations here or in other countries or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
Our wisdom is important, and I'm not going to give it up for the sake of equanimity. I don't think
right. Right. No, we don't ever want to give up wisdom, of course. Wisdom and compassion are the two arms, right? Yes, there is a difference between accepting life as it is with all of it, the beauty and the so-called ugly, or the suffering as well as the joy. So what that means is accepting that whatever group of people is suffering and not bemoaning or playing the ain't it awful game or blaming or judging or that kind of thing, but holding, yes, there is suffering here. And then out of that equanimity, doing what we can. And sometimes it's a very small thing. Sometimes it's a very large thing. I don't know, what just came to mind is hearing one time Jack Kornfield talk about the homeless. And what they most want is to be seen. That they feel invisible, by and large, in our culture. And, hearing that, I realized I, like so many people, how many times have walked past a homeless person and continued talking with my friend or just looked the other way because it's too painful. Or it brings up feelings of guilt, or I don't know what to say or do, or I don't have any money or whatever, you know. After hearing that, I make it a practice, I make it a point to acknowledge homeless people as I pass them. I may not give them money, I may not give them food, I may not do anything more than that. It might be a simple thing, but at least I have acknowledged them. And if it's true, as Jack says, that what they most want is to be acknowledged, then I have at least done that. Then if I have money, or if I, sometimes at this time of year when I make cookies, then I bring them cookies. Does that?
Yeah, that's good, thank you.
Or like with animals, you know, animal suffering is almost more difficult for me than human suffering. I think because, you know, it's humans that perpetuate it. Or it's human perpetrated animal suffering that bothers me. That's a good clarification. So the tendency is when I get information in the mail, I don't want to look at it. I say to myself, I already know that. I don't need to look at that. But in doing that, I may then not respond as much as I could. So, to the best of my ability, and I can't do it all the time, it's too painful, but I do sometimes allow myself to open it, look at the pictures, and read it. Because then I'm more aware, and then I can make wiser choices when I go to buy cosmetics or kitchen supplies or whatever may have been tested on animals.
You mentioned that it's important to not be attached to any kind of result ever. I mean, if what you try to do turns out all wrong, makes everything worse, okay, try not to be attached. But, you know, if I was a causative agent of something, I don't know what,
no, no, what you're talking about now is wisdom.
Yeah.
Yeah. When
it's also one of the forms of attachment that is very powerful. Very, very powerful.
What? What is?
Giving up any sense of responsibility for what I did. Inadvertently, perhaps. Maybe I contributed money to something that turned out to be a very bad cause, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all still on a pretty small scale, but nevertheless, I tend to feel some responsibility for what I did, whether it be large or small.
Again, responsibility, that's wisdom. That's not attachment.
It seems like it's also a kind of judgment.
Well, that depends on how you do it. If you beat yourself up for it, yes. But if you use it skillfully and say, oh, you know, I didn't check that out enough. Next time, I will check it out. Or whatever, you know, you determine that you didn't do. That's skillful. That's wisdom. And you don't have to beat yourself up. You just learn from it, and you do differently the next time. You.
Is there a level this discussion brought to mind, the level of acceptance where, say for animal cruelty, of also accepting that you care passionately and maybe even almost desperately about certain things because you're human, and you see, you know, something, you know, you identify with these other creatures, these other people. Is that part of the process of looking clearly at the things in the world? Because it's also, it's reflected in ourselves, in our feelings, that are also there to be accepted.
That's right. It's accepting all of it. Yeah. The totality. And it is, in fact, recognizing that caring, that passion, that that leads to compassion and leads to wise action. Yeah. The definition of compassion, you know, is the quivering of the heart. And that's what leads us to skillful action. Right. I have found in my life that in all of the joy, of course, there has been a mixture in my life of tremendous joy and tremendous sorrow. But I've become aware that within the joy, there can be great sorrow. Within the sorrow, there can be joy. That's become for me the definition of poignant, you know, and it can be intermingled. It's really very interesting. To be able to see the beauty in what is normally considered horrible or terrible suffering can be very misunderstood. And we have to be very, very skillful, very wise about how we speak about it. But I have seen it. I have seen that that I can see beauty in suffering. And that's not to condone the suffering or to dismiss it, either one. It's to fully accept it, but realize that within the suffering, there is the beauty. It's like it's commingled. It can't be separated. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Right, right.
And you don't have to give up one way of looking in order to have the other.
That's right. That's right. You don't deny that there is whatever there is.
I mean, we wouldn't want, for example, At the same time, we look at them and see that in some sense they're not sick, they're whole.
Right, exactly. Yes, I neglected to say that, but that's right. Like with my grandson, you know, we do everything for him we can. We give him every opportunity, speech therapy and physical therapy and occupational therapy and da-da-da-da-da, so that he can function to the very best of his ability. That's right. But that's within, as you say, the context that... It is, exactly. Maybe an expanded... Yes.
But in my own experience, it's either been on or off this ability to do this. I think it's more on than it was when I was younger. But it's not always there.
Right. Right. And I think sometimes it takes life experience to really get it. We can get it up here, but to really feel it often takes a life experience.
Talking about how prison Bush is undoing a great deal of the environmental laws that permit our environment. And I was having a hard time the acceptance part. And perhaps because it's ongoing, or that you see it occurring and feel a need for action.
I totally understand. It's funny, I had NPR on and I turned it off so I didn't hear it. Yes, I think that's a wonderful place of practice. Several things come to mind, not only acceptance, but part of the acceptance, I think, is seeing President Bush as a fellow human being and not separate from ourselves. That might mean seeing within ourselves tendencies that we see in him. It might just be... I heard a teacher once say, well, that's just consciousness confused. So it might be just recognizing that this is consciousness confused. That, I mean, I think if I look deeply, really, I understand that our president does mostly, maybe not all, but mostly does what he does because he thinks that is the best way. So if I look at it that way, then I can just, I don't have to get so excited or so upset or so angry. It's like, okay, he just doesn't see what we see. So how can I respond? Sometimes I write a letter, sometimes I think, you know, that's pointless, so I might call, you know, at the Environmental Protection Agency or my senator or someone else, that I think that action is going to have more of an effect. And remembering, this is hard, but remembering that we don't know. We don't know. The broken leg kept the farmer's son from going to war. So we don't know. We act, and that's a place to not be attached to the results. Life has its own wisdom. When I really got that, I remember saying to Gil one time, it's not me you trust, it's life. It's like I recognized he knew. He was very nice and said, yes, but it's also you. But I think what he was saying, or what I got, was he knew that whether I did what he suggested or not, you know, life had its own way of taking care of things. and that I may resist what he says. But he never got upset. He never made me wrong for it, because he knew, especially as long as I kept practicing, it would work out. Does that help? Yeah.
I agree with what you're saying in terms of acceptance and wisdom and the story that you told about all the, a lot of life is that way, and so is that. One thing I particularly agree with is the scandal that started in 1989 by the Bush family and their false comedy art and the $1 million. So some things I can't accept. There's a good book, Red, White, the Liberal, The Left is Right and Right is Wrong. And I think sometimes, unfortunately, you have to stand up and fight for some things. And a lot. Some things you have to stand against. Stand against the living.
That's right.
You do have to accept many things, as you're saying, because there is a poetry.
That's, you're absolutely right. There are many things that we need to stand up for. But we can do it in a way that is truly saying yes to life, and that is not resisting, struggling, that doesn't create enemies. You know, that's one thing I find in say, social justice or in taking social action. It's so easy to feel that we are right and then make other people wrong or antagonize them or do things that are not peaceful, that are not the way we want to act.
And sometimes people force us to act in ways that we should not do in order to put them as nature's way in their place so that they don't tread all over us. Like you,
That's true. What comes to my mind just like that is one day I was having a meal with my mother, and she was going on and on and on in what I thought was a very destructive vein. And out of my mouth came, "Shut up!" I was in a restaurant. And I was totally stunned myself. So was she. You know, and I would not ever, I don't think, make the conscious decision to yell "shut up" at my mother in a restaurant. I've thought about that so much since. But I think you're right that there was a place for that. And I don't know that it really changed anything. But well, she did. She did at the time. She did. I don't know if she stopped that habit, but she did at the time. Yeah. But I certainly would never counsel anybody to yell "shut up" at their mother, and I certainly wasn't proud of it. I was kind of like, "Whoa, where did that come from?" But I can see that it was provoked and that it had value.
Sometimes, some things that we really know. And it's not like the answer is way down the road someplace. I could come up with one example. There's a lot of depleted uranium munitions dumped all over Iraq. And it's a fact that that stuff is going to lie there and be radioactive for a good many centuries to come. And our president and the military and our other wise leaders have chosen to remain totally silent about that. So it's just a figment of somebody's imagination. I'm sorry, but I know that that's That stuff is going to be radioactive, whatever you do with it, wherever mm-hmm. you put it. Mm-hmm. And that's a fact. And I can't think that's okay.
No, it's not.
It has multiple consequences to the genetic profile of the people who are going to live there in the future as well as now. And some of our guys are going to come home with those, that kind of damage, and they'll have deformed children.
Right. Right. So that's the point of not condoning. We don't say, oh, that's okay. You know? As you say, these are facts. This is the way it is.
Yeah, it's not opinion exactly.
Some of it
but
might
there
be.
There are difficult choices, and you can go with A, which is a bad choice, and mm-hmm. B, which is just as bad, if not worse. Mm-hmm. And that's all the choices that people can see. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, we even revisit things like this sometimes.
Yeah. The important thing I think to get is that accepting does not mean inaction. Or not doing anything, and it doesn't mean condoning.
Yeah, I would go so far as to say I think that it's fit and proper to get angry sometimes, and that might be one of the times when I would be appropriate. Mm-hmm. Write a pretty strong letter to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What came up last night in our group was Sharon Salzberg's story. When she was in India, again, I've heard it told differently, but she was accosted by a man as she was riding in her rickshaw or getting into her rickshaw or something, and was able to fend him off, you know. And when she went to her teacher that night or the next morning, Munindraji, I think it was, Munindra said to her, Sharon, with all the loving kindness you can muster, you should have hit him over the head with your umbrella. Yeah, that's the same thing. It's like, yes, that is not okay. But we don't make that man an enemy and curse him and stone him. But you might want to hit him over the head with an umbrella and let him know this is not okay. And I'm not just going to stand by and let you do this to me or to somebody else. Yeah, it's in her book, yeah.
In which case,
you know, in Buddhist practice, there's a difference between judgment and discrimination or discernment. Mm-hmm. And as with Dick, I would call that discernment. Yes, there is discriminating wisdom. There is skillful action. But that's different from the kind of judging that that makes things bad or wrong or sets other people up as bad or wrong. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I remember hearing more than once Gil, when he gets into a talk about ethics and good and bad, and things like that, he says that blanket statement, all of Buddhist ethics are situational, which is another way, I guess, of saying you'll be discriminating and think it through and so forth. But, mm-hmm. Life is complicated out there in fear. Ethics are after all the complications. Well, you've got to make a decision sometimes, right? It's practical.
Mm-hmm. And we have precepts that we do our best to live by, and we all know that there are times, for various reasons, that the precepts get broken. That's just how life is. And the beautiful thing about Buddhist practice, I think, is that then we don't go away feeling like sinners, and we don't beat ourselves up. We accept that that's how it was at that moment, and recommit.
You realize that, oh, there was a better way to handle that later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's discriminating wisdom. The judgment would be, oh my God, oh, what a stupid person I am, you know.
I'm going back to kindergarten.
Yeah, that kind of thing, which is detrimental. It doesn't help. Okay, we have 4 minutes. Shall we sit for 4 minutes? a reading from the Tao Te Ching. Do you want to improve the world? I don't think it can be done. The world is sacred. It can't be improved. If you tamper with it, you'll ruin it. If you treat it like an object, you'll lose it. There is a time for being ahead, a time for being behind, a time for being in motion, a time for being at rest, a time for being vigorous, a time for being exhausted, a time for being safe, a time for being in danger. The master sees things as they are, without trying to control them. She lets them go their own way and resides at the center of the circle. Thank you.